What were you like as a teenager?
What was I like as a teenager? Oh my God, it was horrible. Really, really, really horrible. I grew up in a very, very small town. 956 people. Troy, Montana. Now I believe there's 901 people in Troy, Montana. But I was that weird combination of there's the syndrome that gay men have called the best little boy in the world syndrome, where when you feel that you're not enough or that you are different, you need to prove yourself, you become indispensable. You become the best at everything, so people must have you. I was a combination of that and a complete and utter juvenile delinquent.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Richard Fifield about his young adult novel, The Small Crimes of Tiffany Templeton. A full, extended version of this interview is available online at our website, mtpr.org. This interview contains some adult material. Don't go away.
When I was 14, I got caught shoplifting. And I was on probation forever, and guess who the probation officer was? It was my mother, because it was a small town and everybody had like 10 jobs. And my criminal behavior continued all through high school. Senior year, I was the student council president, and I embezzled money from student council. How hot is that? And I bought cassette tapes. So it was a dichotomy. I was indispensable, but I was also a nightmare. I can tell you every prom was amazing because I conceptualized and designed it from the ground up. Every float, amazing. They were lucky to have a gay in their midst. That's all I have to say.
Richard, the book takes place between the small Montana towns of Gabardine and Fortune, where the main character, Tiffany Templeton, has just returned from Dogwood, a reform school. Fortune is three times the size of Gabardine, and you write, their sidewalks and stoplights made Fortune's residents cocky. And of Gabardine, you write, it's impossible to measure a town that was built by drunkards, destroyed by fire, then rebuilt by the sons of the same drunkards. So you're from Troy, Montana. How are you writing to make small-town America dynamic?
I was expecting to have a conversation about, you know, why I choose to write about small towns and why I choose to write about the types of people that I write about. And that is because I am those types of people. You cannot take the small town out of this boy. I live in East Missoula. I still do not have sidewalks. I still do not have streetlights, and I love it. I love that I get my groceries from the gas station. You can't take that away from me. There's a toughness that I need in my life. I need to be surrounded by people who could defend me if there was a zombie attack, right? Because I can't defend myself. I bought throwing knives. I've been practicing.
Okay.
I'm not very good, not at all, but it's fun. So this book was interesting because it was a contract book. Basically, my agent got sick and tired of waiting around for me to publish a book. And so she was like, there's, you know, this publishing company that has an idea for a YA book, and they want a person who has a funny voice, who can write female characters. Do you want to take a crack at it? And I was like, okay. And they sent me like a 30-page synopsis of what they wanted written. And I was like, no, not doing that. I want to write what I don't see in YA, and that is red state, poverty, and a rural approach that's not condescending. There is nothing on the market for girls like me. And so I was like, I'll keep your two characters' main names, but no, I'm writing a book about a girl who lives in a small red state and lives, you know, not a very wealthy life, because every YA book that's on the market is about kids that live on the East Coast that have access to things. And, you know, I don't want that. I only write what I want to read.
It's true. When I picked this book up, I thought, oh, I'm in a different world. I haven't been to this young adult world before. And it holds so much, including parent-child relations, socioeconomic status, racism, sexuality, religion, drugs, fat phobia, juvenile delinquency, infidelity, grief, the arts, and the elderly.
Wow.
How did you bring all of these threads together?
Gosh, you're making me feel like I wrote something that's a lot bigger than it is. It was inadvertent. I don't think you can really write someone's truth without touching on everything, every part of them. Like, Tiffany was the first time that I've ever written a character who could be considered vulnerable. I worry for Tiffany because I see so much of myself in Tiffany. She takes it all in and doesn't know what to do with it. And it comes out sideways. And that's the world of a small town, really. I mean, it's kind of like when your universe is so tiny. If you have a disagreement with someone, or you hate someone, or they're your arch nemesis, if you live in New York City, you might not ever see them again. But if you live in Gabardine, you're going to see them at the grocery store. So it just heightens the drama, and it forces you to deal with the ugliness of the world, because you can't leave. You're 16 years old and you live in a small town. So, you know, it's how do you accept the things that are unacceptable?
I can't wait to talk about your relationship with Tiffany a bit later, but I was hoping that you would read a bit from her point of view.
Sure. I'd be honored to. Seventh grade was also the year I stopped wrestling boys. My body had started to change, which was expected, but after throwing one of the sweet boys to the ground, I felt his boner, which was not. I enjoyed wrestling much more than punching, because pinning somebody down until they surrendered was the definitive win, especially if you did it in front of other kids. I stopped wrestling, and that's when I really started writing, mostly short stories about the people who died in the slasher movies I watched. I gave them backstories. I wasn't satisfied with just letting them be victims. Maybe it was because of how I grew up, where I grew up. Everybody in Gabardine flattened into the roles I was accustomed to, and I could only see them in one dimension. I wrote stories about the lives of fake people, what came before they were just a dead body. I kept them to myself because I knew they were absurdly violent, and because I was traumatized from English class that year and wanted to keep my dangling participles and tense changes private until I could get it right. I always wanted to get it right.
Is there a small-town tough girl stereotype you're trying to disrupt or expand?
Yeah. Hell yeah. To me, you know, it was actually pointed out to me that the theme in my stuff exists. I was like, I have a theme? Oh, my God. I'm not that type of writer. But I always write about people who don't believe that they are worthy of being loved. And it's an inadvertent thing. But those are the characters that I am drawn to. And my favorite character of any that I've ever written was an ancillary character in The Flood Girls, Black Mabel, who just wanted to be helpful and screwed it up every single time, but she just wanted to be helpful. And for this book, the reason I was so adamant about giving her small crimes, and they're really not small crimes. That was the title they gave this book. Who and what you are does not define you for the rest of your life. It doesn't. And when people tell you that, it's, you know, it's an impetus to, you can either go two ways so that you can actually become the thing that they tell you that you are, or you can go the opposite way. And with Tiffany, I, you know, like I said, I really like to write books that I want to read. And I absolutely hate the literary trope of, you know, the bad woman must have her comeuppance and she must have, you know, something must happen to her because she did something terrible so she can learn her lesson. That's not real life. For a straight man, that is real life. For a teenage girl, it is not. And I want to tell all the teenage girls out there, burn it down. For reals, burn it down. This is your world. And if this book encourages girls to forgive themselves and to accept themselves and to realize that mistakes do not define you, then it's a win as far as I'm concerned.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Richard Fifield about his young adult novel, The Small Crimes of Tiffany Templeton. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So glad you pointed out that theme, because I was tracking worthiness and the other one was grief. In the book, Tiffany's mother says, "People grieve in different ways. My daughter chose violence." And this is one perspective, but another interpretation might be that Tiff made art. And I want to know, what's the relationship between grief and art in the book, but also in your life?
Oh, it's time to get vulnerable with Sarah Aronson on KUFM, Montana Public Radio. Let's call this show The Wrong Question. The thing that I've dreaded talking about with this book is the situation of writing it. It was not a normal situation at all. It was very abnormal and very stressful, and I can't even believe I managed to write a book. I signed the contract at the end of May, and the first week in June, my mother began dying. And she'd had chronic lymphocytic leukemia for 15 years, and, you know, her health's been up and down, but the chemo stopped working. And I had a deadline of September 5th. And she told me, whatever happens, hit that deadline. And the biggest pleasure and biggest honor I've ever had with my mother was to become her best friend And it was a long journey to get there. And it sucked because, you know, I had a different relationship with my mother, I think, than the rest of my family did, because I had had to do the work through a 12-step program to accept my mother as a person and not just mother with a capital M. I do accept the fact that she did the best she could with what she had. And when I did that, I was able to drop so much of the animosity and so much of the baggage and just enjoy her as a person. And when the Flood Girls came out, she was so happy. I think she was really happy that I actually used my college education. I was like, I told you going to an MFA school was worth it. But I rented a limousine for a group of ladies from Troy, Montana, for the launch party here in Missoula, Montana. And it was in the middle of winter, and none of them had ever been in a limousine before. And they got stuck on the roundabout on Higgins in a limousine, of course. But I just have these fabulous pictures of my mother getting out of a limousine after drinking champagne, dressed in the nines, and just grinning from ear to ear. And it was like, finally, I am the best little boy in the world. So she told me, because I think she knew that she wasn't going. When you have chronic lymphocytic leukemia, you have your ups and you have your downs. You know, there's always moments where you think this is it. Mm-hmm. And after 15 years, you get spoiled, mm-hmm. you know. And I think she knew. And she said, I want you to hit your deadline no matter what. And I said, okay, I will. And, you know, I had to write 1,000 words a day to hit my deadline. And I chose to do it from 11 o'clock at night until 7 o'clock in the morning in hospitals or at home, because somebody needed to be with her. And I wanted to be that person. And it was also a strangely quiet time. And that's when I wrote this entire book, was, you know, in the middle of the night. And the night she died, I was in the middle of writing a scene, and I had left to go get the nurses and myself junk food from the gas station at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I came back and the nurses were like, it's time. And, you know, my laptop is just open and glowing and I'm in the middle of a scene. I mean, that's how intense I was about writing this. And I just remember holding her hand. And the nurses were the most amazing people in the world. I was, you know, the only person there from my family. And, you know, I held her hand and you just wait for breath and they get longer and longer and longer apart. And the nurse, after about 2 hours, said, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I just heard the rattle. It's coming. Are you ready? And I was like, yes, I am. I'm ready. And I held her hand and she didn't take another breath. And I saw literally life leave her body. And it was an honor because she was my best friend. If she had just been my mother and I had never done the work, I could not have done that at all. And the weird thing was, I had plotted this book out before my mom got sick, and I had plotted that it was a book about a girl whose father had just died. And it was just like this self-fulfilling prophecy, writing about grief while going through grief. And it's a very strange book because of that. There's so much of me in this book. My mom owned a gas station. For reals.
Like Tiffany's mom, by.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My mom owned the town pump in Troy. And seeing a woman work so hard. She was basically, you know, her only employee that was dependable. And she is Vi in the book, except my mother did not have a mean bone in her body. Really. At all. And she was one of the first women in Troy, Montana to own a business. And because of that, in the 1980s, you know, women might own, and I'm not being reductive, but where I come from, women might own a hair salon, maybe. But that's it. My mom owned a gas station. And to me, that is badass. And this is my tribute.
I can imagine you keeping Tiffany company, but also Tiffany keeping you company then.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Really. If I didn't have the deadline, I think I would have gone insane. But I had no choice but to sit down and do my at least 1,000 words every single night. If I did not have that, I don't know what I would have done. I was so mad at God, and I was so mad at life, and it didn't make any sense to me, and it was unfair, and not a great time to write a book. But I did, and I hit the deadline. She passed away on August 18th, and I got them the book September 5th, and I really don't remember it. I think that's what we do with trauma is we turn it off. So when people ask me about this book, I'm like, what book are we talking about? But it's dedicated to her, because the thing that I love about the character of Vi in the book is that she is hard, but she is also, she'll go to the mat for you. She'll beat somebody's ass for you if she loves you. And I wanted to write about a strong woman who was strong on her own terms and did not need a man to define her at all in a small town in rural Montana, which is crazy. She did not need anybody. And Tiffany, very much the same way. Mm-hmm. Tiffany didn't need anyone to define her. And wherever she is now, I hope she stops stealing things.
I have to address David.
Yes.
So while Tiffany's away at reform school, she writes a play called The Soiled Doves of Gabardine. Her best friend David is enlisted to pull together this theater production using women from the nursing home as actresses. And in the book, you write, from David's point of view, "This town needs high art," he said. "We also need reliable internet and cell phone service, but I can only do so much." So talk to me about David, or the part of you that is David-like.
That's me, 100%.
Do you write handwritten thank you notes?
Yes. Sometimes I even make the paper. Are you kidding me? I would make the stamps if it was legal. Just kidding. David is so indicative of that syndrome, the best little boy in the world. He has to have his finger in everything so he is needed. Because when you're needed, you really can't be bullied. We can't beat that kid up because we won't have a prom.
Right.
Or our prom will be tacky and ugly. So let's leave him alone. And he's bored. He's insanely bored. And so is Tiffany. And in Tiffany's boredom, it manifests itself in criminal behavior. In David's boredom, it manifests itself in redecorating life. And moving chairs around. And I mean that metaphorically.
And wigs.
And wigs. And yeah, I mean, it was just kind of like she needed a foil that I couldn't have her write and direct the play because she's not a director. That's not the type of person Tiffany is. she's a sensitive artist, and directors are not sensitive. They are taskmasters and type A and worry warts and stress balls, and I have that as well. So David is his own creature, and I love him so much. And I love the fact that he, if he really likes you, he's super mean to you.
I just realized there's a third character that I wanted to float by you to see if you recognize, which is Tiffany is referred to a probation officer who's a graduate school intern, Kelly Plotz, who's black and works in the probation office. And Kelly supports Tiffany's writing. And I'm thinking about you in the community you work and live in. You support largely women telling their stories, telling the truth. And Kelly becomes an ally for Tiffany. And I just want to know, like, and I've also known you've been a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see yourself in Kelly or not?
Oh, God, I was the worst social worker ever. So I don't see myself in Kelly. You know, the character of Kelly is really interesting because I wanted to have somebody who was also a fish out of water and that could offer a perspective on the town as an outsider. Because Tiffany needed affirmation that what she was going through was not normal, that most people live in towns that have internet. And, you know, Kelly, you know, I wish I'd had a Kelly after my mother had passed away. Because Kelly provided a safe space for Tiffany to be Tiffany. And Kelly was not tolerating any of that leather jacket armor business. You know, the leather jacket was removed. And writing is awesome. And I am so blessed to be able to publish books and to have people read what I write. I mean, I never thought that would happen. That's insane. But I can tell you that the most awesome thing that has come out of my writing is teaching. This last year, we published this anthology called We Leave the Flowers Where They Are. And it was former students of mine over the last 5 years, just normal Montana women talking about their lives. And my grief counselor, she pointed out the reason I was so obsessed with this project was because of my mother.
Yeah.
Because if my mother had had access to a story that made her realize she was worth more than marrying abusive alcoholics, if my mother had had a story where she realized she could leave an abusive relationship, if my mother had had a story where she saw somebody flourish and love themselves and realize they're worth so much more than that, my mother would have had a different life entirely. I would have had a different life entirely. If I had had access to a story where there was a gay character, my life would have been completely different. That story didn't exist for me in 1975 through 1990. If I had had a story where it was okay to be a gay kid, maybe things would have been different. Maybe I wouldn't have been setting fires and huffing gas and shoplifting. But, you know, going out on tour with these women who are so brave and all so completely different, but the one thing they have in common is a fearlessness to tell their truth. It is the biggest honor I've ever had to shepherd that project, because it's, you go to these readings and you have just normal women standing up and telling their stories, And it's the most revolutionary political thing I have ever been involved in. And I have been involved in some revolutions and some politics, but this is real. Like, the very first time I taught the class 5 years ago, a woman came in and she read something, and I knew I had provided a safe space. And she read something that she had never confessed to anyone before, something that she was ashamed of. And when she read it out loud, I saw it leave her body. Like, I saw her body change. I saw her body relax. And it was just like the sweet spot of my favorite things about social work and my favorite things about writing. And also just, you know, if you can't be nice, be helpful. That's my motto. And so I've been helpful, I think. And if I could keep doing women's anthologies and touring all over Montana, what a dream job. And then on the weekends, I could do a radio with Joan Richard here at KUFM, Montana Public Radio. And I would be the happiest person in the world.
You've mentioned the leather jacket. And it's one of Tiff's major symbols. And I just have to read this piece that you wrote about it from her point of view. Every July, motorcycle tours came through Gabardine and refueled, and they could eat 6 hot dogs in one sitting. I didn't care about their appetites. I only saw the jackets, and I knew I wanted one of my own. I saw the uniform as built for travel, built for leaving, armor for tough men who could roar out of town as fast as possible. The other symbol of Tiff's, Richard, is her typewriter, about which she says, "I do things the hard way." And I just wanted to know, what do these symbols represent for her, and how did they come to your mind?
Oh, gosh. It's a terrible thing to say, but it's Truman Capote. I know it sounds so completely bizarre, but I am a Truman Capote obsessive, like obsessive. I even have a Truman Capote t-shirt. But that kid grew up in the South, and I've always identified with his childhood and then what he did afterwards. Because when you come from nothing and you're told you're nothing, and then you make yourself everything, and you single-handedly ruin high society, and then you become addicted to diet pills and go on Johnny Carson and die on Joanne Carson's bathroom guest floor, like, that's life. That's living with a capital L, and I love it. And Truman Capote, there's a sleight of hand. There's an artifice where there's an armor that those of us who don't trust people and aren't vulnerable, we put up defenses so people can't hurt us and people can't get close to us, because that's how we've lived our lives. And it, you know, it stems from childhood. It stems from abuse. It stems from all sorts of things. And a leather jacket is armor, and a typewriter is armor. And, you know, you just, if you see a girl in a leather jacket with a typewriter,
yeah,
you're not going to mess with her.
What are your forms of armor? What do you want to be known for stylistically? How about that?
Well, Sarah, I spent 3 hours getting ready for today's interview, and you can describe to the listeners at home about the velvet ball gown that I am wearing and the 5 hair pieces. And then I forgot that I was on radio. My armor is, anyone who knows me will tell you my armor is my prickliness, my meanness, my self-deprecation. I'm going to hurt you before you can hurt me. And, you know, my armor is control. My armor is being a double Virgo, which is a nightmare combination when you are a creative person. But my armor is, it's defense. It's growing up, looking over your shoulder, thinking that you're going to get your kicked. That's my armor.
What's your hope for the Tiffanys and the teenage Richards of the world?
You know, God bless the internet. It's so hard to explain to people born after the year 2000 what it was like in the 90s in Missoula, Montana. In the 90s, being gay was still illegal. Literally illegal. And, you know, I remember being in Lambda on campus here in the 90s and having Gay Pride Week and just getting, you know, it was not cute. It was not safe. It was not. We had to fight to get to where we are in 2020. And I'm glad these kids today don't have to fight and that they can be accepted for whatever it is they want to be. And for Tiffany and for the Davids of the world, I have high hopes for them. I think by the end of the book, they both are, they've both become agents in their own lives. And that's what I wish for all teenagers, especially teenage girls. Like, you do not have to be anything. But I'm on your side. I'm on your side.
Richard Fifield was raised in Troy, Montana. He's the author of two novels and earned his MFA from Sarah Lawrence. He's the editor of the anthology, We Leave the Flowers Where They Are. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.